Welcome to the Tuesday Brown Bagger right here on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. We bring you the best in Canadian speeches. In September 2002, Canadian Mayor Arar was returning home from a holiday in Tunisia. At his stopover in New York, he was detained. Shadowy American officials accused him of links to the Al-Qaeda terrorist group. The Americans swiftly deported Mayor Arar to Syria despite his Canadian passport. In Syria, he was held in a tiny grave-like cell for 10 months and 10 days before he was moved to a better cell. In Syria, he was beaten, tortured, and forced to make a false confession. It was a case of the so-called extraordinary rendition. The Americans knew and expected Arar would be tortured in Syrian jails. As a later Canadian inquiry discovered, this citizen was snatched and tortured with no evidence against him. The Canadian government was complicit, and finally, years later, the Canadian Prime Minister apologized to Mr. Arar. It is one of the most egregious violations of civil rights and even the Geneva Convention. Mayor Arar was the keynote speaker for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, a left-of-centre think tank based in Vancouver. We'll hear his introduction by Seth Klein, Professor Michael Byers, and Canadian broadcaster Kelly Creighton, former executive producer of CBC's The National News Program. Mayor Arar was born in Syria but came to Canada in 1987 at age 17. He earned his bachelor's and master's degrees in computer engineering and worked in the Ottawa area. His wife, Monique Mazik, is a PhD in financial economics who ran for a federal seat in the riding of Ottawa South. She began a tireless national and international campaign to free her husband and then seek justice. Her book about the affair is Hope and Despair, My Struggle to Free My Husband, published by McClelland and Stewart in 2009. The Arar Commission released its official report on this case in September 18, 2006. Commissioner Dennis O'Connor cleared Maher of all terrorism allegations and found that the actions of Canadian officials very likely led to his ordeal. Justice Dennis O'Connor cleared Arar of all terrorist allegations, stating he was able to say categorically that there was no evidence to indicate Mr. Arar has committed any offense or that his activities constitute a threat to the security of Canada. That's a quote from that report. How could this happen? How can any Canadian or American be taken off the streets and sent to a foreign country for torture? What does this mean for all our civil rights? Arar spoke to a packed room at the CCPA fundraiser about the real price of George Bush's war on terror. Worse, he explains how the security state continues to expand its operations in Canada and abroad even now. At one point, he explained how people begin to adapt by being spied on everywhere. It is this experience of too many Muslim people in too many countries. Now it is the experience of all, even in especially in those so-called democracies. The super-spying machine records even your internet searches, leading to guilt by Google. Watch what you search for. Mayer makes proposals and examples of how we could preserve our civil liberties, what kind of oversight is needed, while we can still remain safe. This speech was recorded in Vancouver at the Fraser View Hall on February 12, 2009. We'll open with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Director, Seth Klein.
We've asked two people to come up and introduce tonight's guest speaker, both of whom have become good friends of Maher and his family in the course of his campaign, Michael Byers and Kelly Creighton. Michael is now well known to many of you for his public commentary on many foreign policy and human rights issues. He is professor and Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law at UBC's Department of Political Science, and I'm pleased to say he is also a CCPA Research Associate and collaborator in the Climate Justice Project. Kelly Creighton is living here in Vancouver only for a few months while her husband, economist Mel Watkins, another great friend of the CCPA, is a visiting fellow at SFU. Kelly was for many years the executive producer of CBC's The National and spent many years as a CBC journalist and senior producer with shows such as It Happens and The Fifth Estate, and brings a particular insight into how the media conducted itself during the Arar affair. Please join me in welcoming Kelly and Michael.
Thank you, Seth, and I'm very honored to be here and to be asked to do this. I'm from Frozen, Ontario, so It's been, in spite of all of you locals who think this is a hard winter, it certainly isn't for us. I'm also very happy to be standing on First Nations land. And I just want to start by saying that I'm only too aware of the popular perception that journalists are either flax for a socialist nirvana or drones for corporate Canada. Reality, of course, lies elsewhere. While many, if not most, in the mass media actually want their work to enlighten citizens and by proxy help build a better world, in the daily maelstrom of swirling events, too often, like our readers, viewers, and listeners, we are also swept along by the seemingly forceful ideas of established power. The reasons for that are the subject of another day. I am here tonight to introduce you to a hurricane so forceful that it swept away the assumptions of the powerful, carried the media along with it, and in a new dawning, helped Canadians understand in a gut sense the true meaning of justice. I'm speaking, of course, of the Meharrar affair. By the time I, as a semi-retired journalist, crossed over to the dark side, as my colleagues would see it, into PR, specifically media, volunteer media assistant to Meher during the Arar inquiry, Meher and Monia were already iconic figures for Canadians. Far from having to find a way to promote their agenda, my task was one of managing the many calls on his time to find the most productive way of helping the story make a difference. But how did it happen that in the time of the great fear that we Canadians came to see that this man was someone we could look to preserve the values we hold dear, when those we paid to protect us were telling us he was someone to despise? The answer is instructive. From the beginning, Monia Mazig refused to accept conventional wisdom. She rejected the old Canadian adage of quiet diplomacy. She spoke out directly to Canadians, forcefully, vigorously, tirelessly. When finally she brought her husband home, battered and mentally bruised though he was, he joined in her call for justice, not just for himself, but for others. I learned a lot about Meher sitting near him as he did countless interviews with national and international journalists. With all, the story was the same, the emotional intensity the same. Sometimes more details would emerge, and as I listened, I became even more respectful of this man whose ordeal had been so cruel, so senseless, so unfair. I did not have to coach him. I had only to listen to his own needless worries about whether or not he was making himself heard. In working with Meher and Monia, there was no message track to develop, no spin to weave, no concerns about the public mood or how far you could take things. They used their heads and spoke from their hearts. They spoke the truth. They held back nothing, and they never feared from their goal of clearing Meher's name and changing a system that had allowed this to happen. Their story is a lesson to all of us who are involved in promoting the cause of good politics and social justice campaigns, and maybe even by proxy, helping to make the world a better place. Thank you, all my relations, and I'm happy to turn it to Michael.
Well, now, I'm the only thing standing between you and an incredible speech. So I better keep it brief. I think most of us now have a fairly full appreciation of the contribution that Monia and Meher made to this country. I'm going to turn your attention to the impact that they may have had on our world. Here in Canada, we saw them stand up together after Maher's return from that horrid prison in Syria, challenging the authorities, challenging our politicians, insisting on a public inquiry that led ultimately to a definitive clearing of Maher's name and a formal apology from Stephen Harper. The impact in Canada in terms of opening our eyes to the importance of civil liberties and to the values that we ascribe to that as a country is a very important contribution. But the contribution elsewhere is perhaps much more important than that. You see, when Maher was released from that prison and brought back to Canada, and when he and Monya stood up to clear his name, they shone a ray of light into the dark world of George W. Bush's so-called war on terror. They were the ones who opened the eyes of remarkable journalists like Dana Priest at the Washington Post and Seymour Hersh at the New Yorker. They were the ones that began to call into question the veracity of George W. Bush's assertions and the professionalism of the CIA. They were the ones that began that vitally important process of undermining the moral authority of the American president. It's difficult to measure the impact of two human beings on world history. But I think that Monya and Maher's contribution was extremely important in revealing that terrible practice of extraordinary rendition, the ghost planes, the dark sites, the waterboarding and other forms of torture, that they and their story may have prompted some troubled and well-meaning civil servants and military personnel in the United States to begin to leak the story. That they may have started the cascade of damning evidence. That they, in some small way, might have contributed to the release of those horrible photographs from Abu Ghraib. And that they might have contributed centrally to the fact that both of America's political parties chose to nominate as their candidates men who were publicly opposed to torture and committed to shutting down Guantanamo Bay. It is even possible, and this may be a serious stretch, but it is even possible that our two fellow Canadians, Monya Mazig and Maher Arar, contributed in a meaningful way to the election of Barack Obama as the President of the United States. I don't know whether that's the case. There were, of course, many different factors, but I do know one thing, that I am in the very rare and privileged position of introducing a man who has changed the course of human history and done so for the better. Maher, the floor is yours.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for this warm reception. Michael and Kelly, thank you very much for kind words and the warm introduction. I would like to start this evening by thanking the Coast Salish people for their hospitality and generosity and for allowing us to be on their traditional lands. I would like to thank you for this. Equally, I would like to thank CCPA for giving me this opportunity to be with you tonight, so that I can share with you some of my thoughts about how the post 9/11 environment has affected our lives. The topics of civil liberties, human rights, accountability, injustice have been the subject of media headlines for the past few years. My main message today is that we are at a key point in our shared history, and the choices that we make as a nation going forward are important ones. Our task is to make the right choices both for security and for civil and human rights. The choices that we make, we must live with. And I want to be very clear with you that these choices will have profound and lasting impact on our lives. I personally believe that the security environment that has evolved in Canada since the events of 9/11 has damaged Canadian society by putting our national security needs and our desire to satisfy the security concerns of our neighbor in the south ahead of the liberties and rights that are guaranteed to us as Canadian citizens. We live in a society that has prized freedom and democracy and has held these principles up as specific characteristics that make us different from other societies. Like the United States, we had been willing to oppose or intervene in the affairs of countries who do not support these values, on account of the fact that we would hold them to be primary rights of human rights. Yet, since 9/11, we have willingly accepted heavy erosion of the very freedom and democracy we value in the name of protecting national security. Unfortunately, this damage to our freedoms and liberties occurred with the willing support of many of our politicians who believed that Canada needed draconian anti-terrorism legislation to fight the terrorist threat that was facing all of us. There is no doubt that Canadians need to be secure and feel secure. At the same time, however, without human and civil rights, we have no real security. We must ensure that the government does not end up facilitating acts of injustice against Canadians in the name of protecting its citizens. In my opinion, the best way to achieve both ends is to implement all of Justice O'Connor's recommendations, especially when it comes to the establishment of a single oversight agency for the RCMP and other government departments that collect, disseminate, and share national security information. Until the Harper government implement these recommendations, we Canadians are running the risk of having another repeat of the Arar scenario. I'm sure you've heard about other Canadians. In fact, there was another follow-up inquiry called the Kibuchi inquiry. So my case cannot be portrayed anymore as a unique case. It has happened to many other Canadians, and what we don't know, whether similar things happened to other Canadians who sometimes prefer, for many reasons, to keep things, to not go public about it. And that's why the need for this kind of oversight agency is extremely important.
You are listening to Mayor Arar, the Canadian citizen who was swept up in the war on terror. With the connivance of the Canadian police, Arar was arrested at a New York stopover, only to disappear into a Syrian jail for torture and beatings, a case of extraordinary rendition on an innocent citizen. He was since cleared of any wrongdoing by a major Canadian inquiry and received an apology from Prime Minister Stephen Harper, as well as a financial settlement from the Government of Canada. This is CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. We'll continue with Mayor Arar.
When the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was entrenched in our Constitution in 1982, there was much hope that the rights of individual Canadians or groups of Canadians would no longer be subject to the political whims or unilateral actions by the government. There was hope that this document would ensure that Canadians, regardless of their race, religion, or ethnicity, would not be subjected to the kind of injustice that takes place in many other foreign countries, where mere suspicion condemns an individual to being arrested and held without charge or torture, in some cases, summarily executed. The worst thing that has happened after 9/11 is that the U.S. government has exercised direct or indirect pressure on other governments, both Western and Eastern governments, to rapidly modify their laws in order to accommodate this new war, which was called the War on Terror by the Bush administration. Under the banner of this war, mere suspicion is enough to brand others as terrorists. Hearsay evidence becomes accepted and due process completely vanishes. Under the name of this war, suspected terrorists are rendered to other countries to be interrogated by torture, hence bypassing international obligations and treaties such as the Geneva Convention that clearly prohibits torture or even sending people to countries where torture is practiced. Here at home, it took our parliament less than 3 months to adopt C-36, which is our version of the Patriot Act. And this unfortunately happened despite the clear warnings from human rights and civil liberties organizations. In my opinion, even if the expanded police powers in this law were rarely used, as often argued by the government, it gave the police, the RCMP, a carte blanche when investigating national security-related offenses. Perhaps one of the most frightening aspects of the post-9/11 security environment is in the area of torture. In democratic, compassionate societies like Canada, the very idea of torturing suspects detained by the states is abhorrent. It is unjustifiable, illegal, and above all, it is immoral. Despite this, during the past few years, we have heard American politicians, members of the legal community, as well as members of the public call for the torture of terrorist suspects if it results in information that can be used to enhance national security. How can we even consider using torture as a legal mean or a legal tool, and at the same time to continue to claim that we are a civilized democracy? How can we consider such immoral and illegal techniques and then condemn human rights violations abroad? Torture and the use of information obtained under torture violates Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedom. Most importantly, it demeans all Canadians as human beings. Technically, despite the torture, the abuse and mistreatment of suspects, the world is no safer, nor is the threat of terrorism reduced. The statistics regarding terrorist activities that took place since 9/11 prove what I have just stated. Secrecy. It seems to be taken for granted that security requires secrecy. But to what degree do we need this secrecy? And for what purpose is it really used? From the outside, it is difficult to tell. We are told that we have to trust our government agencies and believe that they deny access only to truly sensitive information. We are also told that we have to trust that they do not withhold the truth from us for other reasons. It seems that every time the veil of secrecy is lifted a tiny bit, of course, against government wishes, we see a truth that was hidden not because it affects security, but because it confirms what the government and its agencies spent so much time denying. Just to give a concrete example, we were eventually, after a court battle, we were eventually given access to some of the redacted material from Justice O'Connor's public report, which was blacked out because it was deemed that portion of the report deemed to be or deemed to contain information vital to national security. That's what we were told. Only to find out later that much of this information showed that CSIS knew early on that the Americans wanted to send me to the Middle East, where I could be interrogated through torture. Up until the release of these blacked-out portions of the report, the government, and especially CSIS, has always denied that they knew in 2002 about the existence of the rendition program where terrorism suspects are sent to other foreign countries for the purpose of extracting information under torture. In my opinion, if CSIS had acknowledged early on the mistakes it made, it could have earned the trust, the support, and the respect of many Canadians. I think that one of the most important lessons to be learned through the public inquiry is the need for responsible oversight for our national security organizations. Since 2001, we have seen a huge increase in security spending, but very little on oversight mechanisms that would ensure that our national security organizations were responsible, accountable, and ethical. Over 2 years ago, Justice Dennis O'Connor released the first report from the Commission for Inquiry into my case. A few months later, he released his second and final report in which he recommended the creation of a comprehensive oversight agency to watch over the national security security activities of the RCMP and other security organizations. A lot of Canadians don't know, by the way, that CSIS and the RCMP are not the only departments or only agencies that are involved in national security-related matters. There is about 10 or 8 others. Some of them belong to Foreign Affairs, others belong to the Department of National Defense. And that's why Justice O'Connor in his report clearly said that this oversight agency, because of the integrated nature of this information gathering, that should oversee not only the RCMP but other departments as well. Unfortunately, here we are 2 years later, our national security agencies still operate without the benefit of comprehensive and credible oversight agency as was recommended by Justice O'Connor. As Canadian citizens, we need to be able to trust that our national security organizations are also accountable to us as people, as individuals who also need their protections as much as our nation does. No fly list. A few months ago, the American government has demanded that Canadian airlines hand over the personal information of passengers who take flights that pass through U.S. airspace on the way to southern destinations. Their intention, we are told, is to prevent certain known or suspected terrorists from boarding an aircraft where they may jeopardize the lives of passengers and others. This proposal will allow the American government to intercept and force the landing of planes that carry passengers who are deemed a threat to the United States. As a side effect, it will also provide the U.S. with more data about specific Canadian citizens, data that will remain, as we all know, in U.S. security databases indefinitely, to be used for whatever purposes they want. We have put a huge amount of money into our own border security. Like it or not, Canada has already established its own no-fly list, which was developed in close cooperation with the U.S. We are told, however, that our no-fly list contains the names of no more than 1,000 people, compared to 700,000 people in the U.S. But much like the U.S. list, there is very little that we know about what names it contains and for what reasons individuals have been flagged. Worst yet, once an individual finds out that his or her name is wrongfully on the list, there does not seem to be an expeditious way to have it removed. So Michael and Kelly, maybe your name is there right now. Are you ready? In my opinion, our list, like the U.S. list, fails us in its secrecy. We can know nothing about it, but that it exists, and we can guess little about it, apart from the likelihood that, like its American counterpart, it is similarly flawed, containing names of individuals who have done nothing wrong. The American list has sounded the alarm bell to stop U.S.-bound flights based on such threats as innocent children and elderly. And if I remember correctly, one time a U.S. senator. I would like to spend some time talking to you about what we call total surveillance society. In fact, just today in the Globe and Mail, there was a front page article about the fact that the government is trying to push a bill or pass a law that would allow the government to tap onto your internet communications. Just in case some people ask themselves the question whether what I'm going to be mentioning here is going to happen or not, or at least they have the intention. The degree that we are under surveillance is growing every day, and the structure of our growing surveillance is moving toward one end: total surveillance of every public action and a startling amount of your private actions. Recently, we have seen the problems of increased surveillance far sooner than we have seen the advantages, such as the revelation that CSIS was using wiretaps to listen on the conversations between individuals held on national security certificates and their lawyers. Just for those who may not be aware, we have our own version of indefinite detention in Canada. It's called, it's basically a minister could issue a certificate based on some information that a person is a threat to society, and this person could be held indefinitely. So we are told recently, I think about 6 weeks ago, we found out through a court order, through court motion, that CSIS was listening on the conversation between these people and their lawyers that is supposed to be protected. And of course, the reason that CSIS gave is because of national security. So I always wonder what kind of national security information they're looking for. Will this person be talking to the lawyer about what? About a plot? This is just an example to show that their definition of national security seems to be different from ours. So everything becomes justifiable, basically. Now, in terms of public surveillance, we have become more and more accustomed to video cameras to the point where we can no longer even notice them. Some are quite useful in our daily lives, such as weather cameras that we can access through the internet nowadays, or security cameras in urban areas, where both men and women are at risk of assaults and other crimes. The presence of these cameras, when obvious, can deter crime. Where they are hidden, they can also help bring criminals to justice. Most of us, if asked, would likely support the presence of these cameras, and many of us might even offer the opinion that we need more of them. However, the type of surveillance that is truly on the increase is not just this public type, but a more private type. It involves more than just video. It involves data from your telephone records, data about your travel history, data about where you work, who your friends and acquaintances are, what you purchase, and where you purchase it, what books you buy and from what publishers, the magazines that you read, and the very words that you use on the telephone or on the internet. By the way, have you heard about this new term called guilt by Google? It's out there. Be careful what you search for. In fact, I'm quite nervous sometimes at home. My son is very fascinated with skyscrapers and bridges. I'm not joking. It is reality. And he keeps typing all of those keywords. And what do I tell him? You know, he's 7 years old. And so just to tell you, it's real. All of this data combined with variables like your ethnic background, your education, your age, your religion, your political leanings, sometimes based on just the available public record. If you think that this is not available, you are sadly mistaken. In the U.S., major telecom companies have already provided the government with access to their core network, providing them with a rich supply of data, both voice and digital communications. And that's exactly what our government is trying to implement. It's exactly, if you read the Globe and Mail article, it's exactly, it mimics 100% what the U.S. has done. The U.S. government has also bought vast amounts of commercial transaction information as well. And many companies volunteer to supply their data, knowing that all major credit card companies are U.S.-based. In fact, they're U.S. companies. It is safe to assume that your purchasing habits and transactions are not private anymore. All of this data about you becomes a profile, a model of who you are based on available demographic and psychographic characteristics of similar profiles. And what we need to understand most clearly is that this technology is not meant just to help convict suspects. It is meant to predict suspects and prevent their potential actions. It is meant to look at each and every one of us and declare a degree of risk and to watch for changes in data that might signal an impending threat. In other words, you and I are not judged. We're not anymore judged on what we have done, but we are judged on what we might do. And that is a very dangerous loop. Now, once our surveillance systems have the means to predict within a certain margin of error, they will no doubt be used to detect potential threats, we are told. But how do we calculate the margin of error? And how do you make up for the error? By the way, this is real. It's happening here in Canada. Some educational institutions like the University of Ottawa, where I'm doing my PhD, has received funding. And apparently there are some professors who are specializing in this kind of techniques and technologies. So this is real. The government is spending a lot of money on those gadgets.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Our speaker is Mayor Arar, the Canadian sent off to Syrian jails for torture as part of the war on terror. He spoke at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives on February 12, 2009.
In my own case, an entire team of human investigators, now I'm talking about human agents, which are supposed to be more intelligent than machines. In my own case, an entire team of human investigators flagged me as a terrorist and followed my abduction and torture in Syria with interest. When the allegations against me fell apart, anonymous members of the national security apparatus went so far as to leak misleading information about me to the press. First, to prevent my return to Canada, and next, to discredit my protests of innocence. It took years and an official public inquiry to clear my name. Are we so much better prepared and equipped now that the statistical leads provided by complex data mining algorithms? Algorithms that actual investigators have no hope of comprehending will suddenly provide the security that we hope for. The U.S. government, NSA, have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on supercomputers to spy on on virtually all the world communications and to look for keywords, and they've devised algorithms. So this is what we call data mining, and they look for pattern in your emails, like keywords and so on. Now, assuming that this new direction in security is fully implemented, how will it affect us? Without responsible oversight, where will it lead us? When we have grown accustomed to this, how will we react as a society and as individuals? And I assure you that we will grow accustomed to it, just as we have grown accustomed to other things. At first, suspicion, self-doubt, and anxiety will be a burden that we will all feel, but eventually we will adapt. There will be, of course, some accommodations to be made, some adjustments, and what's more, we will be able to do certain things to keep ourselves from looking more suspicious than we really are. I'll just give some few examples. We can stop traveling, or at the very least, make sure that we do not travel to suspicious places. Avoid traveling to places of importance or large population centers. Traveling to these too often might be a bad idea, unless you can really back up your reasons. You might really love San Francisco, but is it really worth the risk of sticking out? Wichita, Kansas might be a better place. We can stop donating to suspicious organizations like CCPA, for example. We can avoid religious practice unless it is reasonably mainstream. We can take careful inventory of your friends and acquaintances. We probably don't really need all of them. Pare them down to a list that is easy to be certain of. We can certainly control our family members and ensure that they are not behaving in such a way as to raise concern. We can be more careful with what we say, avoid certain topics, curb our opinions. What use is free speech if it can draw too much attention to you? Try not to say anything unless if it has already been said by the right people in the right places, preferably on television or in major newspapers. This is in response to your achievements, by the way. If you need to have an opinion, take a good look at what the government has to say about an issue first, as it is likely to be the safest position to take. Do not sign petitions or protest. This will only lead to trouble. Be proactive. You never know what activity or behavior will be suspicious in the future. Being Muslim was fine until September 2001, and your past is a hard thing to take back. You should always make sure that you are prepared to deny not just who you are, but who you have been. Be very careful who signs your rental leases or similar personal references. If there is any question about how your friends might be perceived, do not take the chance at all. After all, how well do you really know anyone? You're better off for going a good reference. Finally, do not despair if you get called in or taken in to explain yourself. This is important. It is the human factor and can smooth over inconsistencies in your profile. Do not think of your questioners as interrogators. Think of them as your friends who are only trying to help you. This is reality. Many of the things I mentioned here, yes, it's on my mind, and I think it's a reality that the Muslim community, I would say across North America, have been vulnerable. So it's the Muslim community today, and I assure you, I've spoken to many of them, and they all have this anxiety, and those ideas are on their minds all the time. So today it's the Muslims, tomorrow it's the maybe Chinese community, who knows. It seems clear that the previous American government has lost its way and abandoned its principles and values. It resorted to kidnapping, harsh interrogation techniques that fit within the definition of torture, as well as torture by proxy through rendition flights. It abandoned law and human rights for the sake of expediency. Our own government agencies have not been immune from similar practices. They have cooperated and continue to cooperate closely with countries that have questionable human rights record. Justice O'Connor did not recommend our agency stop the sharing of information with any country, but he clearly established check and balances that put the protection of rights and freedom ahead of illusion of security. He states in his report, I'll read from his report, information should never be provided to a foreign country where there is a credible risk that it will cause or contribute to the use of torture. Policies should include specific directions aimed at eliminating any possible Canadian complicity in torture, avoiding the risk of other human rights abuses, and ensuring accountability. We really have no idea whether the 23 recommendations Justice O'Connor published have been implemented. We are told by some government agencies, like especially the RCMP, that they have been implemented. But what is clear, the most important recommendation of Justice O'Connor, which is the oversight part, we have not seen any sign that the government, unfortunately, is about or will implement this specific important recommendation. Now, coming back to the total surveillance society issue, let me say that the current trend toward this society, total surveillance society, is a dangerous one. For every bit of promise that it holds, it also contains risks of misuse. At the worst, it is an expensive impossibility, and at the best, it is bound to provide a significant amount of misleading information. And without responsible oversight, this is a huge concern for all of us. Worst of all is the risk of our security organizations putting too much faith in their technology alone. This is a very human tendency, by the way, and one that history has shown to pay poor dividends. The great risks of attempts at total surveillance is that it presents itself not as a tool, but as a solution. It actually diverts, that's the worst part. It actually diverts resources away from things that we can do to actually make people safe. Canada has been well known for promoting human rights internationally. But its voice, unfortunately, has flattered in recent years. It has become clear that we no longer have our own voice as a nation. It is as if Canada has learned to accommodate, unfortunately, to look the other way as human rights are abused, to see our self-interest in the approval of the American government. And there are many examples that you can point to. You know, the treatment of prisoners in Afghanistan is one good live example. Our troops, unfortunately, have allegedly been involved in torturing detainees. And there's a current government initiative to try to prevent disclosure of public information about what exactly happened. Having lost our own moral compass hand in hand with the previous U.S. administration, it seems that all we can do at the present is wait and see if the new U.S. administration hands it back to us and gives us permission to again value human rights and civil liberties. This seems to be our reality, unfortunately, our national reality. But it isn't right. This is not right. There is no bravery in it, and there is no integrity in it. It is not the Canada that I know. We do not need permission to reclaim our national character. In our dealings with other nations, we must insist that torture and other lawless behavior in the name of protecting national security is not acceptable. We We simply cannot look the other way while our partners in national security crush human rights. Our government's silence on these issues is inexcusable. The issue for Guantanamo Bay is a concrete example. While all Western democracies have asked for the closing for Guantanamo Bay and the repatriation of their citizens, our own government has been silent on this issue. Is it not time for our government to ask for the repatriation of Omar Khadr? The last Western citizen languishing in Guantanamo Bay. Is it not time for our government to understand that it is no more about what Omar Khadr did or did not do? It is about us as a nation, about what we did or did not do. Yeah. Prime Minister Harper still has time. His meeting with President Obama next week. It is my hope that he will raise this issue with him. We can only hope. As I have mentioned, we have done a great deal to accommodate the needs of the heightened American security. We have adapted our national security policy to work with our American agencies, or with the American agencies. We have also increased our border security. We have even gone so far as to develop a no-fly list that is based on the American model, and this was developed in close cooperation with American security agencies. We have done a great deal, both in terms of spending, restructuring, and communicating with our security partners. However, it is time now to very carefully examine our national security policy, our relationships and our relationships with our partners and our practices and laws. We need to do this while respecting human rights instead of regardless of human rights. And most importantly, we need to do this as a sovereign and responsible nation. If we proceed in spending our resources building a surveillance state without investing in oversight, we will have gained a certain type of security, the same sense of security enjoyed by Syria and other dictatorships. We can learn to live like citizens in these countries do, anxious, suspicious, and closed off. One effective way, in my opinion, of eradicating terrorism that is often ignored by our politicians is to play a role in stabilizing and strengthening of the political and economic infrastructure of many of the poorer nations of the world. In this way, we will not only be investing in their security, but in ours as well. In addition, we need to examine what we can do at home to help Canadians understand each other better. We need to show Canadians in very concrete ways that cultural or religious differences between communities should not be seen as an obstacle or threat, but as an opportunity to further enrich Canadian society. Furthermore, we need greater involvement by citizens. You have a lot to offer in the debate on civil liberties, human rights, and their connection to national security. The real lesson for the past 7 years is that our security laws affect all of us. Because we are all affected, we must have a truly open and inclusive debate about these laws and practices. A debate that embraces all Canadians, regardless of their political, religious, or cultural identities. I believe we still have time to catch up. Canada was seen as a leader in peace and justice. With the help of our minds, hearts, and our commitment to social justice, we can restore that lost reputation. Finally, we need to ensure that what we do in Canada has an impact on the rest of the world. Our voices must be heard globally, and our struggle for justice should know no boundaries. As Martin Luther King has said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Thank you very much.
You have just heard Mayor Arar, the Canadian victim of an extraordinary rendition to Syria as part of George Bush's War on Terror. His wife, Monique Mazik, a PhD in financial economics, fought a tireless national and international campaign to free her husband and then seek justice. Her book about the affair is Hope and Despair, My Struggle to Free My Husband, published by McClelland and Stewart in 2009. The Arar Commission released its official report on this case on September 18, 2006. Commissioner Dennis O'Connor cleared Mayer of all terrorism allegations and found that the actions of the Canadian officials very likely led to his ordeal. Justice Dennis O'Connor cleared him of the terrorism allegations, stating, quote, he was able to say categorically that there is no evidence to indicate that Mr. Arar has committed any offense or that his activities constitute a threat to the security of Canada, end quote. Find more about Mayor Arar at the mayorarar.ca website. This is spelled M-A-H-E-R and then A-R-A-R.ca. You can support the work of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives at their website, www.policyalternatives.ca. It is one of the few non-corporate think tanks in this country. I'm Alex Smith. Join us next week for more great Canadian speeches. This is Midnight Oil with Beds Are Burning.
Give it back.